Over these last several weeks, we've been hearing a lot from Jesus. Not that we don't usually hear a lot from him in one way or another, but the gospel readings this month have given us Jesus in his most direct, most challenging, and most uncompromising. Sometimes, I confess, I prefer hearing about Jesus than from him. His parables can cut to the heart. A few weeks ago, Jesus was calling us out on how we practice hospitality. When you give a luncheon or dinner, he said, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors in case they may invite you in return, and you will be repaid. And when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed. And a couple of weeks ago, Jesus told us that the most important thing was to forgive and to never stop forgiving. Last week, we heard Jesus tell us the story of a vineyard where everyone gets the same reward, no matter how long or how hard they worked. A parable of grace that shatters everything, especially our notion of what's fair. And now this week, it's the parable of the two sons, the yes and no brothers. These sons are not as well known as that other pair of sons we have come to know from the Gospel of Luke, the prodigal and his understandably outraged big brother. These sons are just two ordinary guys asked by their father to go work in the vineyard. One says no, but then actually does go to work. The other says yes, but then never shows. And Jesus wants to know which one did the will of the Father. Now, if we have learned anything over the last few weeks, it's that this is probably a trick question, and that Jesus is really getting at something much deeper, much bigger. Jesus is the master teacher, the parable teller extraordinaire, and there's always a lot more going on in these stories than first meets the eye. First of all, you need to know who Jesus is talking to when he tells these stories, and who's nearby listening in. In the stories we've heard over the last few weeks, Jesus has been mostly talking to his disciples, the ones who supposedly know him and might actually understand him and can be expected to give him the benefit of the doubt, at least at the start. But today he's addressing a different crowd, the chief priests and elders of the people. His disciples are nearby, listening in. Now, it's easy to make the chief priests and the elders of the people into the bad guys in this situation. After all, they aren't interested in following Jesus. In fact, they wish that he would just go away. It's easy to make this a story about us and them, good guys and bad guys. But remember, the disciples are standing on the edge of the crowd, listening in. We can't miss the fact that this is also a word for the disciples. And that means us. But Jesus is not just speaking to us indirectly, to us disciples standing there on the edge of the crowd. The fact is that in our world, we are the closest thing to chief priests and elders of the people. We are the members of the religious establishment. We represent the status quo. So we might expect that this parable will hit us from all sides. Don't say I didn't warn you. So the chief priests and the elders of the people are out to get Jesus, or at the very least, to put him in his place. They don't like him because he challenges their authority, disrupts the balance of power, questions their traditions, and gets the people all riled up. Jesus is making trouble with Rome, and the Jewish community of the first century in Palestine just can't afford that. The key ingredients of the Pax Romana, that tentative peace enjoyed by the Jews, is cooperation, containment, and keeping a low profile. And Jesus is wrecking everything. Healing people, blessing children, eating with all the wrong kinds of people, wreaking havoc in the temple, claiming to be the Son of God. Enough is enough. And since they can't yet get rid of him, the temple authorities decide to confront Jesus on their own turf. The temple, after all, is their church, right? And here's Jesus, the carpenter's son from Nazareth, teaching them about the Torah. It's time to straighten him out and put him in his place and show him who's boss. By what authority is he doing these things? They want to know. Just who do you think you are? That will show it. Everyone knows who's really in charge in the temple. It's the chief priests and the elders of the people, of course. So where do you get off acting all holier than thou and on our turf, no less? Answer that. Now remember, Jesus is a Jew. And he had learned a thing or two from watching the rabbis, and he knows that the best answer to a loaded question is not to fall for the trap, but to ask a question of his own. Let me ask you this, he says. Did the baptism of John come from heaven? Or was it of human origin? Now, sometimes you answer a question with a question simply to put the other person off balance or to avoid giving any information or just to annoy them. But in the tradition of the rabbis, answering the question with a question was understood as a way to deepen the debate. It was a way to get at the real question, the question behind the question. By whose authority do you do what you do, Jesus? Well, by whose authority did John the Baptist do what he did? Now the ball is back in their court. How will they answer? It's a tough question, even a trick question for the chief priests and elders of the people. Remember, a lot of people are listening. They are on the edge of the crowd to hear how they will respond. A lot of people who liked John the Baptist, a lot of people who followed him before they followed Jesus, a lot of people who were convinced that John was a prophet of God. By whose authority did John do what he did? If they say John's authority came from heaven, then the question is, why didn't you believe him? If they say the authority is of human origins, then the crowd might just lose it. It's a classic catch-22. Heads, I win. Tails, you lose. It looks like Jesus has them cornered. And all they can say is, we don't know. But this is not the end of the story. Because Jesus is just getting started, and he's not really interested in the question about authority anyway. He has bigger fish to fry. So he tells a story. A man has two sons, Jesus says. They're both teenagers. They say whatever they think. They do whatever they want. They drive their parents crazy. And one day, the man tells both of his sons to go to work. One says no, but then ends up going later. The other says sure, anything to get dad off his back, but he doesn't really feel like going. And so he doesn't. Which one ends up doing the will of the father? It's such a simple question, it's got to be a setup. And it is. Still, the crowd is waiting for the priest to answer. Finally, they say, the first son. Even if he was disobedient in the beginning, in the end, he did the right thing. He did the will of the Father. And then Jesus said, truly I tell you, it's usually a clue that you're not going to like what comes next. Truly I tell you, the people you despise the most, they are going into God's kingdom ahead of you. The people that you hold in the worst contempt, the ones who gross you out the most, the ones you think barely have a right to live, they are heading through the pearly gates ahead of you. You think that you are the ones who can call the shots and are in God's good graces, but you've actually got it all wrong. God isn't interested in all your pious words and your high opinion of yourself. God isn't interested in how well you protect your turf while the poor are poor. God isn't interested in what you say if there's no follow-through. God cares about what we do. Jesus isn't interested in what we say or what we've done, for better or worse. He's interested in what we do, what we end up doing. Jesus here sounds a lot like the prophet Amos, who took on the holier-than-thou of his own day with some pretty harsh words. When Amos said, I hate, I despise your solemn assemblies. I'm not impressed with all your holy words as you go through your holy motions. If you're not following through with action, with transformation, with growth and change and new life, if you're not deepening your faith and cultivating your love and putting your money where your mouth is and seriously trying to live out the things you so solemnly say in your comfortable sanctuaries, I don't have any time for you. This is a hard word. And as one commentator rightly points out, this is the kind of talk that got Jesus killed. When he told the chief priests and the elders of the people which brother they were the yes men. The ones who said all the right things, believed all the right things, stood for all the right things, but who would not do the right things that God called them to do. And so now they were in for a big surprise. Jesus told them that the tax collectors and the prostitutes, people they despised, were going into the kingdom ahead of them. Not instead of them, but ahead of them. People who may have said no at the beginning, but who now changed their minds and went, while those who refused to go continued to mistake their own convictions for obedience to God. The tax collectors and prostitutes sold their souls and their bodies. How much lower can you go? But when they heard John the Baptist preaching about repentance, about turning around, about the forgiveness of sins, Jesus says they got it. The ones who sold out started buying back in, started changing their lives, or trying to anyway. First, they said no, and their lives said no. But then something happened. Something started to happen. Something that the Holy Spirit, first through John and then through Jesus and now through the church, something started to happen. And it started to happen slowly, surprisingly, until that no morphed into a yes. Until the last and the lost and the least actually wanted to head out into the vineyard. And they actually did. They went to work in the vineyard, and the work was hard and asked a lot, but it was surprisingly satisfying. They put a smile on their face and they experienced joy. So what does it all mean? At least this, I think. God doesn't care where we are. God cares where we're going. The chief priests and the elders of the people are stuck. They aren't going anywhere. And of course, there were plenty of tax collectors and prostitutes not going anywhere too. But Jesus is talking about the ones who are going somewhere. The tax collectors and the prostitutes and the chief priests and the elders of the people and the sullen teenagers and anybody else on the edge of the crowd listening in who are moving and growing and doing all kinds of things for the sake of the kingdom. The sinners and the saints and the ordinary Christians who are awake, alert, paying attention to God's call. And doing something about it. Or even just wanting to do something about it. God doesn't care where we are. God cares where we're going. No matter how stuck we are in our mindsets, our habits, our relationships, our addictions, no matter how stuck we might be as a church, it's not where we are, but where we're going, what we're doing that matters to God. The present, no matter how all-consuming, does not define us. The present, no matter how fixed it seems, does not limit us, does not condemn us, not as far as God is concerned. Whoever you are, whatever you are, is not as important to God as who you could be, as who you are in God's eyes. The way I see it, it doesn't matter so much who we are. New Christian, mature Christian, new sinner, seasoned sinner, churched, unchurched, lover of God, lover of idols, to God, the God of hope, the God of resurrection, the God of new life, the God of possibilities, the God of tax collectors and prostitutes, and of chief priests and elders, to God, it matters a whole lot more where we're going, what we're doing. So where will God send us? And how will we answer? Not just with our lips, with our yes or no, but with our lives. Friends, I can't wait to find it. Thanks be to God.